Good morning. Welcome to Farm Foundation's forum on tools for agricultural research. Our audience is a little short this morning, but I think it's the cold weather outside and some of the school delays have probably nibbled away at the margins. So welcome to all of you who braved the cold temperatures this morning to make it here. We have a great program on tap this morning, and Urban Lenner will tell you about that in a minute. First, just a couple of things. Welcome from Farm Foundation to this forum. We are audio casting the forum thanks to support from the Farm Credit System. And so when it comes time for Q&As, please avail yourself of the microphone, and please be sure to identify yourself so that the folks out in the remote audience will know who's asking the questions. With that, I'm going to turn the podium over to Urban and let him introduce the panel and get things rolling.
Thank you, Neil. We know a lot of things about ag research. We know that it produces powerful returns on investment, both public and private. We know that it's absolutely essential to meeting the challenges that face agriculture, to meeting the challenges of new pests and diseases, of climate change, of maintaining the health of our soil and water and air, of producing healthy and nutritious food, of feeding the world. And we also know that public support of it has, by and large, over the last several decades, been stagnant. If you look at the comparison between USDA research funding and NIH research funding between 1989 and roughly 2003, in 1989, NIH was already about triple USDA. Since then, actually about six times USDA. Since then, NIH funding has tripled, and USDA research funding has barely increased by a very small amount. And yet we know we can't meet these challenges of the future without it. And so there's a constant dialogue going on in agriculture about how we're going to solve this problem, how we're going to organize and raise new funding for agricultural research in the future. There's a lot of promising things going on, and we've got an impressive panel of people here today to tell you about them. It's my pleasure to be the moderator. I've been asked, because this is being audio cast, to introduce each speaker in turn rather than introduce all of them at the beginning. So I'll start by introducing our first speaker, Keith Fugley, who is a researcher, economist at the Economic Research Service of USDA. He's been with USDA for 15 years, I believe. He has been a senior advisor for economic policy on the President's Council of Economic Advisors. He's worked in Africa and Asia with various research organizations. And it's my pleasure to ask Keith to open up.
Thank you, Urban. What I would like to do is just spend a few minutes to talk about some of the funding trends in agricultural research, particularly funding for public research, and also to explore a little bit about some experiments or some policy reforms that other countries have employed to try to raise support for agricultural research and how they have fared and what lessons they may have for the United States. So over the long-term trends, if we go back over the last four decades, we can see that in real terms, after discounting for inflation, the blue line here shows the stagnation that Urban referred to in funding for public agricultural research. And this is research by not only the USDA, but by the land-grant universities, our public system. There has been growth in the private agricultural research. Now, the solid red line, that shows both food by food industry and by ag input industries. And then that dashed blue line just shows the private agricultural input industry R&D. So that's for by seed industry, by chemical, farm machinery, animal health, and so forth. So there's still most of the research oriented toward the farm economy, toward farm productivity, remains in the public sector, but the private sector has been growth in that part. But as we look at the entire system, we see that, you know, in the agricultural innovation system, both the public and private sectors, both the state and federal governments, play very important and strategic roles in the whole system. So what this figure illustrates is the who funds research and where that research is performed. And this is a composite we put together for 2009. It's a little difficult to get all these pieces together on a more timely basis. So bear with me, and this is a little bit out of date, but the overall picture really hasn't changed very much, I don't think, since then. So we see the private sector funding a lot of research, mostly in their own industry labs, and about half of this, as I mentioned, is kind of oriented toward production agriculture, and the other half by the food industry, which is mainly the development of new food products and so forth, and processes and manufacturing processes, not really related to agriculture. So most of the more agriculturally oriented research here in the public sector is either done in the land grant universities and state agricultural experiment stations, or other cooperating institutions like veterinary schools and forestry schools, or by the USDA intramural labs, and that's primarily the Agricultural Research Service or the Forest Service or my institution, the Economic Research Service. And as you can see, most of the money for intramural research comes from the federal government administered through the USDA, but the land-grant universities get a range of funding. State governments appropriate money for them, USDA extramural support, but also other federal agencies, National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health. We see money coming in to the Colleges of Agriculture. And then there's this private sector support. Now, this isn't all corporate money. A lot of this money is from nonprofit foundations, also sales of products, technology fees that these universities are earning are included in this. This is basically all non-government sources of funding. So one other thing to point out is there is some small transfer of money from the private sector to the federal labs and from the USDA to the private sector. But the financial, there's lots of technology flowing there, but in terms of finances, those are actually fairly small amounts of money at present. So if we think about funding this research, one of the, in terms of the public sector, one of the challenges is that the federal and state appropriations for public research, which is really funding much of the more fundamental or basic research needed to, you know, keep productivity, develop, you know, breakthroughs and new technologies that will keep productivity running over the long run. Those funding sources, as Urban referred to, have been under particular stress. And so then one of the issues is, well, can we diversify funding and get more funding from other sources to support this more fundamental research at public institutions? And there has been some movement toward more diversified funding over the last 20 years. And so this figure shows, so the USDA intramural part, so this would be funding at USDA research laboratories. And the rest of the curve, the rest of the pie chart is basically what's funding the land-grant universities and state experiment stations. And here we see the real fall off in state government expenditures to support that research, and the growth of non-government sources for funding, and also funding from other federal agencies. If I would have, and this is, if I would have shown this for just a few years ago, like in 2009 or 2010, the USDA intramural research would have been a lot smaller. But just in the past few years, as the state part of this pie has shrunk, these other parts have expanded. So it looks like the USDA is kind of taking on a larger role than they were even just a few years ago. But one of the challenges, of course, is to see whether we can continue to diversify these sources of funding to maintain this system. Now, in addition to funding for more public research to do basic sciences, there's also been a major effort over the past several decades to increase technology transfer from public institutions into the private sector. And that partly reflects, as I mentioned, the growing technology capacity, R&D capacity in with private firms, but also this has been enabled by a number of pieces of federal legislation, such as the Bayh-Dole Act, the Stephenson-Weil Technology Transfer Act, that set up new institutions to incentivize greater collaboration between the public and private sector research. And we've seen this, the USDA, for example, the red line here is the number of cooperative research and development agreements, or CRADAs. So these are specific agreements we have with individual companies in which we pre-assign intellectual property rights, we pre-negotiate that. Each public sector and the private cooperator contribute money to develop a particular technology. We also spend money through this SBIR, this is the Small Business Innovation Research Grants, where the USDA allocates funds to individual companies, usually to support research on something of interest to the USDA, such as biofuel development. And then there's a number of patents that the USDA owns. This is the red line is the active patents, the blue line is the active number of CRADAs. And we do get a small amount of revenue from these patent licenses, but the patent licenses are really beneficial to help speed up the rate of technology transfer, but they have not been a major source of new revenue. And that's true not only for the USDA, but for public universities in agriculture and more broadly across the economy, that licensing helps get technology to private firms, but it hasn't been a major source of new revenue for public research. Now, I mentioned there's been experiments undertaken in other countries, and I'd like to refer to three experiments that were really implemented in the 1980s and 1990s by Australia, the United Kingdom, and Netherlands, basically trying to incentivize industry to take a bigger role in supporting agricultural research. Australia implemented a program in which the government agreed to match funding from industry and from producer groups for research at public institutions. Dollar for dollar up to some level. And so now really about half the money for public research comes from the industry and half from government. The UK and Netherlands privatized certain parts of their public agricultural research and extension systems to try to get industry more involved. And as we go back now and look at how those experiments played out, we find that, you know, the impact was rather mixed. I think that they were all successful in bringing more industry participation in, but not necessarily successful in raising overall support for agricultural research. Sometimes it was mainly just a substitution of private money for public money. And in particular, in the UK and Australia, they had difficulty maintaining strong support for the fundamental long-term research necessary to keep that productivity frontier shifting outward. And a couple of decades later, we found that in both those countries, productivity growth in the agricultural sector stagnated, and they're starting to then lose competitiveness in agriculture. Whereas Netherlands continued to have robust funding not only from industry but government, and have maintained rather impressive productivity growth in their agricultural sector. They're a very competitive international player in agriculture today. Just to conclude with where the United States now sits in this global picture, we can see that over the long term, these are dollars spent on public agricultural research by the Western European countries, the 15 countries of the old EU 15, as well as China. And we see that there is some risk that the United States may be losing global leadership in agricultural research. Particularly, we see this tremendous growth taking place now in China in their funding and support for agricultural research as they really try to improve the quality and of their whole research and performance of their research system. And also in the last few years, while support in the United States has dropped off, in the EU 15 countries, they've continued to show some growth there in agricultural research. So with that, Urban, I'll turn it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Keith, for that excellent overview. Our next speaker is Harold Browning. He is the Chief Operations Officer of the Citrus Research and Development Foundation, which is an industry-led effort to combat the citrus greening problem in Florida. Having walked through an orange grove with Harold a couple of weeks ago in Florida and seen the devastating impact of this disease and hearing him discuss the problems in organizing response to this kind of a challenge to agriculture. I think you'll very much enjoy his presentation.
Thank you, Irwin. Good morning. The Florida industry is iconic for the presence of citrus for over 200 years now, and it's an important part of our culture, but more importantly, it's an important part of the economy of the state of Florida. And today I'm going to give a quick overview, kind of a case study. It's not a case history because the story is not finished, but give you a little perspective on the Florida industry and the challenges that Wong Long Bing or HLB or greening has brought to the industry, and the industry's response in organizing to meet the challenges of this industry problem. Is this model working in solving the problem? How it interfaces with some of the federal and other funding programs and funding sources available? And really what the benefits and perhaps the challenges are associated with an industry response to come forward. The Florida industry is about 500,000 acres. It's close to half of what it once was in terms of acreage, still very viable and produces over $1 billion farm gate per year and a $9 billion impact on the economy of the state. And I'm going to talk today about Florida, but one of the issues is citrus is a national crop, and so Texas, Arizona, and California, and a little bit in Louisiana represent other states that are involved in citrus, and they're at very different places with regard to this disease, and I'll make some points about how to coordinate among states as well. For those of you that aren't familiar with the disease, it's a bacterial systemic disease that's transmitted by an insect, the Asian citrus psyllid. So the insect feeds on the phloem of infected plants, and in feeding on healthy plants transmits it. The bacterium is a primitive species that has very little known about it, is not culturable, and has been a real challenge to us in understanding. And of course, the citrus plant, which is also exotic to the United States, is highly susceptible. And this is a very specific system. The psyllid, the bacterium, are very specific to citrus and its close relatives. And the impact of the disease on the crop, it spread through the state of Florida within 3 years. Essentially, all the commercial citrus in the state had been exposed to, and within a grove, the trees infected. So it goes to systemic movement. Roots are infected and debilitated. You see a decline in the tree, like you can see on this photo here. And ultimately, through multiple years of chronic infection, the stress of holding fruit through the harvest season, which is right now in Florida, causes premature fruit drop. In the last 2 years, we've lost 13 and 18% of the crop just prior to the time the grower's going to pick it. So it's a real moral dilemma to see your fruit falling on the ground, real devastating. So this gives you an idea of some of the players, and in gray are funding agencies as well as organizations that conduct research. There are a number of industry organizations here. These are local organizations that support growers. And then we have regulatory agencies here. And the challenge for us in Florida was, who do you go to? Where do you find solutions to this problem? And the answer is, there's a role for all of these groups to play. And I'll just highlight here, this is the National Research Council of the National Academies of Science. So if you look at that, that's kind of the dilemma that agriculture has when a problem pops up. And I'm really speaking about a very acute crisis that the Florida industry is facing and may not survive. So one of the important things, I think, from an industry response is you've got to do planning, and hopefully I can make some points to convince you of that. But we contracted with the National Research Council and asked them to come in and look from the outside with a panel of competent scientists to help design a business plan as well as a set of priorities and a pathway for the research. And that publication is listed here. It's good bedtime reading, 328 pages, and so it really was very helpful in solidifying the approach that the industry responded with. And as a result of that study and discussions within the industry, the Citrus Research and Development Foundation was established 2009. It's a 501c3. It's organized within the state of Florida and affiliated with the University of Florida, so we're really quasi-government, if you will, and our funding flows through contracts with state agencies by and large. It's governed, however, by a board of directors that's composed of 10 citrus industry representatives and three state representatives from the university and the State Department of Agriculture. We have committees that provide oversight and governance, and those are also heavily populated by industry. So it really is driven by the industry itself. Our board meets monthly, and as the COO, that's a real challenge. But the timing of need to move forward is really stressed by the fact that our board has met monthly for 5 years. Our meetings are public, therefore they're noticed, and anyone is welcome to attend. All of our information is publicly accessible. And interestingly, the industry, one of the first things they said is, we want to keep the management lean. We want the growers to see their money going into research, not into building an infrastructure. And as time goes on, we realize the need to add more capacity. We are a funding organization. We do not conduct research ourselves or development, but rather we contract it out to public institutions, private corporations, and anyone else who's interested in helping solve this problem. So the purpose for the foundation was really to advance the knowledge and deliver solutions to keep Florida citrus alive and competitive. And we have a number of committees that have that charge. First, for prioritization, we have a committee. We run a competitive grant program with an annual call, ad hoc reviews, a scientific advisory board that meets as a panel to advise. But most importantly, we have a grower research management committee who takes the input on the science and translates that into the needs of the industry, and they make the final recommendation to our board for funding. Another unique aspect of this, and I think you'll see the value of it as I move through here, is that we have a commercial product delivery organization that's emerged to take the results of the traditional research model and move it forward. Our goal is not for scientists to publish papers, but hand off solutions to the growers. And one of our committee members said, I need something behind my tractor. I don't need to read another paper. So this committee meets specifically to identify and facilitate partnerships with research results and all the IP that's associated there to field trials, commercialization, regulatory. So we have a group that's really the handoff organization within CRDF to make that happen. We've funded scientists in 27 states with universities, both private and public. We funded USDA laboratories across the country, and we have funded research in various countries that have capability to help here. And our typical portfolio is about 125 to 150 projects at a time. So to the theme for today, where does the funding come from? This is a bottom-up, grower-driven, and the first budget that was approved to undertake this program was about $16 million committed from the Florida citrus industry through two mechanisms, and they're listed here on the slide. State marketing orders first for research, and secondarily there's a marketing order for the promotion and marketing of citrus and citrus products. And those taxes collectively raise $60 to $70 million a year. And initially, the industry diverted promotion and marketing funds to establish the research. And since then, we've tried to diversify our portfolio. We have half a million to a million and a half of donations that come to us, largely from allied industries associated with citrus, who also have a lot at stake here. We have attracted state legislative funding, both directly through the appropriations process, but also competing for dollars that are available for programs. And we have experience with three federal agencies, ARS through specific co-op agreements, NEFA program. We have a current project that's 5 years and $9 million to look at the underlying science of developing a psyllid that's incompetent to translate the disease from tree to tree. And then finally, we have co-op agreements with USDA, APHIS, or operational programs to try to deliver some of these shovel-ready projects to the field. So if you look at this slide, prior to 2006, the industry rattled along with $1 million to $2 million a year research box tax focused on horticultural, weed science, variety development, and so on, to kind of keep the status quo of the industry. And we had a grants program, but it was obvious that with the onset of this disease in 2005, we needed a broader response. So the square in this slide indicates the investment since that time, and it's been in the range of $15 to $18 or $19 million a year combined from the sources that I just mentioned. I wanted to spend a couple of minutes to make the point that this is complementary to the federal programs, to the publicly funded efforts, to private industry's efforts to help solve this problem. Obviously, the ag input industries have products and tools available to us. And so this slide kind of integrates. If you look at the Farm Bill and the Specialty Crop Research Initiative, which allocated in this recent passing $25 million a year for 5 years to support HLB research, corresponds with our understanding long and medium-term goals for the foundation. The congressional appropriation to APHIS to help move shovel-ready projects into the field corresponds to our short-term and delivery area, and we are partnering with them. In fact, I'm a member of the MAC committee. And then finally, the USDA APHIS has an ongoing citrus health response program, which is an in-the-field operational program. So there is integration there, and to the challenges of keeping that understood across the broader front, that's a really important effort. So the benefits of this industry-organized effort may be clear, but I just wanted to highlight some of these. It really has to do with the fact that the growers are fighting for their lives, and they need near-term solutions. They need solutions right now. In 5 to 10 years, they need resistant plants so they can replant the industry. And in the meantime, the available mechanisms did not hold a guaranteed solution to that. So there's shared governance. There's a lot of flexibility in our programs. We can invite proposals to translate from the research findings to a private company, and we can go and meet with EPA and talk about the needs and the technologies that are emerging. So we have a lot of ability to facilitate not just one sector of the research picture, but the entire process. And it's all open. It's a public, open process that all of our decisions are made in a public forum. So one could argue that the growers typically aren't interested in the fundamental science, but this is a list of some of the areas surrounding Wang Long Bing and citrus that have moved forward with support and funding from the CRDF and the industry of Florida. And not to overstate that USDA in its various capacities also has worked in this area. But since this project was brought forward, we have elucidated the genomes of many citrus varieties. We have the genome of the psyllid. We have a genome of the bacteria that causes the disease. A lot of more fundamental studies that you would expect in a national competitive grant program have been underpinned with support from the industry. And the reason for that is this disease was largely unknown when it came to the United States. And so we were very interested in making sure the science moves forward. On the more practical side, this is a list of some of the things that are actually of importance to the growers. And when I talk to them, this is what I show. The near-term commercial tools, whether it's vector insecticides to suppress populations or attractants and repellents and that sort of thing. We've looked at a lot of repurposed agricultural products to see if they will play a role in either health maintenance of the trees or in fact therapies against the bacterium itself. So there's a lot of real near term. This is why we exist, to move these things into the field. And then finally, just some of the challenges. The Florida citrus crop is half of what it was 10 years ago, largely due to this disease. And because we're box tax funded, that means the funding available to us is 50% on a per box basis from what it was 10 years ago. When you go to a grower meeting, they're focused on today. They may be tolerant of thinking about the underlying science, but they're really focused on today, and that relates to challenges for continuity. I'm asked every day, Harold, when are you going to solve this problem so we can move on? And there's a risk that we fail in meeting the timeline expectations for the industry, at which time the whole thing can kind of unravel. And of course, we have limited scope of funding, and that's largely driven by the industry. And so as they are successful or not, we could run into problems of maintenance. And then when this crisis is over, many growers have the attitude, okay, we've solved this problem, let's go back to the $1 million a year program. And to underscore that point, agricultural research at the commodity level, at the national level, is grossly underfunded. So those are my comments. Yeah, appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Harold. In the 2014 Farm Bill, Congress created a vehicle, a new vehicle for agricultural research funding, an independent foundation that will match public and private money in pursuit of worthwhile agricultural research projects. Our next speaker, Matthew McKenna, is a senior advisor to the Secretary of Agriculture. And someone with familiarity in both the public and private sectors in the past, in addition to working for a big law firm in New York, he had a career at PepsiCo, in which he finished as senior VP for finance. He was the chief executive officer of Keep America Beautiful for a couple of years, and he's going to talk to us about this new foundation and what it will do.
Thank you, Urban. The Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research, as Urban said, was created by Congress just recently and as part of the last Farm Bill. And it's important to put this in the context of what we're talking about today as a incremental source of funding for agricultural research, but one that's narrowly targeted but is perhaps built on a narrow foundation, but has the potential for tremendous expansion. The history of the foundation is brief. It was authorized by Congress as part of the Farm Bill, as we've said. Congress also authorized an initial grant to the foundation of $200 million. That is a lot of money, but as Keith showed us in his slides earlier, it is not a whole lot of money, but is perhaps a down payment on a rich future for the foundation. I thought today I'd give you a very brief background of the creation of the foundation, the purpose of the foundation, where it is today, and a little bit of a view towards what we might be looking forward to as well. The foundation was organized last summer, again, pursuant to congressional authority. The money was transferred to the foundation last summer, end of last summer, so it has $200 million in the bank. At the same time, we recruited the initial board of directors for the foundation. It's important for me to say that while I am looking over the foundation and helping the foundation get started, it's important to recognize the foundation is an independent organization, an independent board of directors with a variety of ex officio members, but self-governing and self-authorizing its actions. It is just starting, and it's a great time to be here, Urban, to be talking about it, because initial basic decisions are being made as we speak. The Board of Directors, I thought I'd just put the names of the members of the Board of Directors up here and go through them very quickly. And I won't read their names, except I see Keith is looking over my shoulder, so maybe I will read their names for people on the panel. But it's a wonderful group of people, and in our initial meetings, I've been very impressed, obviously, as a financial person, been very impressed by the depth of expertise the board represents. But Dr. Bohr from Cornell, Dr. Cordova from the National Science Foundation, Dr. Nancy Kramer from North Carolina State University, Dr. Delmer from University of California at Davis, Dr. Bueller, Michigan State University. Our chair of our board is Secretary Dan Glickman, Dr. Horsch from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, representative from USDA, ex officio member, Dr. Jacobs Young, Pam Johnson from National Corn Growers Association, one person who does not have doctor next to her name, but is a remarkable person, and I've enjoyed working with Pam tremendously in the past several months. Dr. Keenum, president of Mississippi State University, Dr. Laddish from Purdue University, Dr. Chris Mallett, who's at Cargill these days, Dr. Mattson from the Stanford University, Dr. McElwain, from who helps us on the veterinarian side, from Washington University, Dr. Prusner, who is at University of California, San Francisco, from USDA, Sunny Ramaswamy, Dr. Safe from Ohio State University, Dr. Shaw from Washington University, Secretary Vilsack, and Dr. Wotecki from NRE at USDA. It is a tremendous group of people, but as I was saying over coffee earlier, it's interesting, it's a brand new group of people to work together. And as a new board, it takes a while for them to become used to their activities, to recruit their own ideas, to affiliate and to assimilate how they want to go forward. And that's the process we are in right now. From a progress report, the board has had a number of board meetings. Our next meeting is next week, as a matter of fact. We have organized the board into committees. The committees are a governance committee, a scientific review committee, a financial committee. The Scientific Review Committee in particular is going to be the group that has the initial authority over which grants, which research is going to be conducted. It's important that Congress, to note that Congress created some very specific restrictions around their initial grant of $200 million. And it's a practice that shows up in a couple of spots in the Farm Bill, and that is the matching concept. The purpose behind the congressionally authorized grant of $200 million is to require that that money either match or be matched in specific research proposals. It's meant to leverage that $200 million into at least another $200 million, or a total of $400 million. The matching at least has to be one-to-one. It doesn't have to be only one-to-one. The foundation, for example, could ask that in its grant of a dollar be matched by $2 or $3 of outside support. But that matching concept, which has been used in other places in the Farm Bill, and which the USDA is actively exercising that matching authority in other areas, is an interesting position. It's a way of assuring that the agenda of the foundation be consistent with somebody else's agenda as well, requiring a reaching out, requiring an assimilation with the rest of the research dollars that Keith showed us exist and are out there today. $200 million is a lot of money, but it's not a whole lot of money in the scope of the research that's done today, or certainly the research that's necessary. Another restriction, another guardrail that Congress put on the $200 million is to have the research project supplement and complement the work that USDA is already doing. This is not meant to be exclusively a gap filler with respect to USDA projects, but it is intended to supplement the work that is already being done. How the board interprets that supplementary role is being discussed right now. But within the context of matching dollars and supplement what USDA research projects already are, those are the guidelines behind the $200 million. As I said before, the board has met in person already once. There's been a number of telephonic board meetings. Our next meeting is next week, as a matter of fact, here in Washington. The purpose of this meeting will be to determine the strategic plan and the operating plan for the foundation going forward. We have yet to hire an executive director. That will be next on the agenda. But ideally, following the board meeting next week, we'll be able to talk publicly about what the strategic plan for the foundation as it spends this $200 million is going to be. To help the board decide that. We've done a number of benchmarking exercises. We've talked a great deal to other foundations in the Washington area. For example, the Foundation for NIH is a good example of how a sister organization has begun, become very successful in my point of view, and maybe there's lessons there for this foundation as it begins its life. Another great example is the National Fish and Wildlife Federation. Again, two organizations which started with humble beginnings and have matured into vibrant forces in their space. And that's what I want to conclude with. As I think the opportunity for the Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research is not just to spend this $200 million matched on some basis with other funders against important research that needs to be done. But there's also a leadership role that it can serve, and that is to expand the $200 million to grow its asset base, ideally with future congressional authorizations, but that's not necessary, really. The importance, I think, is message that I'm going to give the foundation at the next board meeting, is that they have the opportunity to create a voice for agricultural research, to be a leader in agricultural research that is separate from the sources that Keith mentioned before, and to recruit and solicit additional contributions from the private sector, from the public sector, from other nonprofits, and to grow that $200 million in a fashion that allows it to further meet the gaps that were implicit in Keith's presentation of research that needs to be done for the future. Thank you, Urban.
Thank you, Matt. So at the risk of vastly oversimplifying, we have so far heard from Keith Hughley about what I would call the past. And we've heard from Harold Browning and Matthew McKenna about the present. Now we need to talk about the future. And one of the organizations most interested in the future of how we organize to fund agricultural research is the Samuel Roberts Noble Foundation in Ardmore, Oklahoma, a nonprofit that conducts educational and consulting programs, but also animal or agricultural and plant science research. Steve Rines is the Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of the Samuel Roberts Noble Foundation. Steve, tell us about the future.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. We are talking about the future. So what I appreciate the opportunity to share with you about agricultural research organizations. I believe more than anything, and from what we've heard here, is the opportunity to leverage private wealth, that from individuals and that those from family, serve as the greatest opportunity for this sector to expand. What I'm going to talk about and I'm going to touch on is where our sources are coming from today, which we've heard a little bit about. We're going to talk about models that we might be able to borrow from the medical research area, and then we're going to conclude with ag research organizations and what they look like. So if we look at where the money flows today, and Keith really lined this out with more tangible numbers, but we've focused on public funding. And this is a slide that we put together not only for our trustees at the Noble Foundation, but also our faculty. And this has been represented in a variety of different ways, but what you see here is a trend. It's not an anomaly of where we are. We have been underfunded for decades. And how we feel is while we have to continue to work to maintain where we are, and we need to seek incremental gains is all this is going to offer. So we need to get innovative. We need to look for new approaches. This is going to turn us to, of course, industry funding, and it's got its own restrictions. We have to return a profit, or industry is not going to invest its money. So it will serve a need. So what I'm going to focus on is really this philanthropic funding and what it looks like. We get a little bit, as Keith pointed out early on, we get a little bit of money from that area. And it's primarily made up from contributions to universities. As you know, our innovation engine is set up around the land grants. So how people give to it, unfortunately, is not really causal. So if you look at human medical research, we give typically due to a passion, Alzheimer's, diabetes, cancer. What you see in donations to universities is typically alma maters. I don't seek out who's doing bovine respiratory disease research. I give to Texas A&M because I may have come from there. That's a challenge. The other one is private foundations. There are more than 86,000 private foundations in the U.S. We only have a handful that are giving to ag sectors. Now, granted, if you look at the 20 or 30 that do, it's great to have the Gates Foundation on our team. If you're going to have one member out of 20, let's make it the biggest one. But there is an opportunity here to educate, to bring in those programs that already exist. But more importantly, let's begin to look to the future. What models do we need to create? Who do we need to recruit into philanthropy to provide additional revenue streams? The way we're going to address this is look at our sibling, public medical research. So we talk about they too have university foundations and institute development, much like we do. They've probably gone a little bit broader because they tell a different story, but there's room for us to improve there. Government agency foundations, Matt just talked about it. We didn't have this tool before a year ago. You look at the Foundation for National Institutes of Health, which he mentioned. It is successful. We've brought that now to our sector, and let's learn how to capitalize on it. Again, private foundations, they're typically based on passion, and there's usually a lot of wealth behind them. We aren't leveraging those to get people who are interested in our sector, interested in a species, interested in a geography, to move into this philanthropic area. And then lastly, medical research organizations. I wouldn't expect anyone in this room to know much about them because they're fairly small and they're unique. I want to touch on a little bit of their attributes and why we think they're valuable. It's a 501c3, very familiar with that. They don't live outside of the 501c3 umbrella, they're under it. So they're subject to all the same requirements, annual reporting, transparency, publishing of research. They were created in the mid-1950s, so they're not new. They've been around just a while. They're focused on the physical or mental diseases and impairments of man. Now, regrettably, when they drafted the regulations, had they dropped off of man and said living organisms, I wouldn't even have a reason to be here today. But somewhere down the line, they created of man, which means they are limited to medical research. Unlike many 501c3s, such as private foundations that have restrictions on how they operate, very positive requirements of MROs. Directly conduct the research themselves. They don't get credit for grants. They're typically based on an endowment, which is not up here, but that's what makes them common to private foundations. There's an expenditure requirement. Individuals or families of wealth that put their money in these institutions aren't allowed to keep it there. They're required to push out a minimum amount each year in the conduct of research to further the sector. And lastly, very uniquely, probably one of the first evidences of public-private partnerships was evidenced in this last requirement. MROs have to work with hospitals. Great public policy behind it. One, are they aligned with what hospitals are doing? There's no question hospitals are here for the improvement of man, but there's also education, there's research, and there's, of course, dissemination. So what Congress did here was very innovative in the mid-1950s. Today, there are about 200 of them operating across the United States. The top 44 expend a little over $2 billion a year and employ more than 16,000 people. What you should sense out of this is it doesn't take a lot of these to make a dramatic impact. A lot of options. A lot of options we don't always see in agriculture. Why are there so many options, and do we even really need them? To look at that, let's take a step back and look at the donor that's giving to these. So if you have someone giving to a university, an institute, an agency foundation, what you typically see is a donor who is very comfortable with giving their money to someone else to manage and invest. I'm comfortable with the underlying organization. The Red Cross is someone I'm comfortable with. I don't ask how they spend it. I just simply give a donation. That's a class of giver. Private foundations. Typically, you've got a donor, maybe an individual, maybe a family, who's bold enough to start a whole new institution. They want to define their programs and problems, but again, they're very comfortable with giving their money away. Think about the Gates Foundation. Mr. Gates and his wife, they set up the foundation, they endowed it. They define the problems that they want to tackle, but they find other scientists at universities, private institutes, government, to undertake that research. Down this same vein, you look at the founders of medical research organizations. Again, bold enough to set up a whole institution to conduct research. They define the problems and programs, but they go one step further. They may want to assemble a team as to how they want to tackle that problem. I give you some examples, and we're not going to dwell on them, but I encourage you to look up some of the stories behind these institutions. We understand the Gates Foundation and what they do. Very publicized. We understand how private foundations work. Medical research organizations, three examples: Howard Hughes Medical Institute near D.C. here, the Van Andel Institute in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and the Stowers Institute in Kansas City. The story behind the Stowers Institute is phenomenal. Jim Stowers, who's founded American Century Mutual Funds, wanted to change not only the way gene-based therapies were created, he also wanted to change the way Kansas City was regarded in biomedical research. If you look at the parallel in his story to the founder of my institution, Lloyd Noble, and how he wanted to change agriculture and restore the Southern Great Plains to prominence after the Dust Bowl, they parallel one another. Thus, I'm saying medical research founders here are not much unlike agriculture. They each have a passion, and in these cases, they each have wealth, and they want to change the world with that wealth. And then lastly, you look at Paul Allen, also of Microsoft fame. He's using these vehicles in a variety of different ways. He created an MRO to conduct brain research, very targeted, very focused. But then he also uses a private foundation to invest in other sciences and technologies. It's a lot of options. What you should take away from it is one size does not fit all. We've been living in a world in the agricultural sector where one size should fit all, and it's not the case. The other thing to take away, or philanthropists are born, they are not made. And that's the way the IRS looks at it as well. If you're born with the gift of giving, you will find a place to put your wealth. If we don't have that place, we're gonna miss out. And what's at stake? Generational wealth transfer. It's estimated in the next 50 years that almost $100 trillion will change hands. Between 2032 and 2036, more than 10% of the investable assets will change hands. When you look at the giving pledge that Mr. Gates and Mr. Buffett initiated just recently, they are encouraging those of wealth to give away at least a half to society and philanthropy. These folks are in our sector. These folks have a passion for whether it be soil, plants, animals. And if we don't have places for them to put their money, they won't. So what we need are new tools, additive options. And it's important to focus on additive. In our sector, and I can say this because I've experienced it over the last few years that we've been working on this, our sector more than any other believes that things are mutually exclusive. If I support one, I cannot support the other. It's too many options. We can't progress. I like the status quo. This is not our mindset going forward. So what are agricultural research organizations? Regrettably, they're not too original because they follow medical research organizations. They would be a 501c3, again, living under the requirements of 501c3s. Annual disclosures, publications covering research outcomes. They would operate very similar, direct conduct of research, expenditure requirements. But while hospitals make no sense for ag research, we borrowed from the idea that in every state there are land-grant colleges and non-land-grant colleges of agriculture. These would be the partners. These are a tremendous investment has already been made in each state. Many states have multiple. We know the expertise is there. It would be set up so these institutions would be required to work with universities. Challenge: it requires a modification of the tax code. This is not easy. And what we begin to see is most of the constituents who would benefit from this, those with a passion for ag, this is not where the relationships have been. Many of us have relationships in on the Hill, but they're not with tax staff. They're not in these committees. It is to be influenced and impacted by Senate Finance and House Ways and Means. This measure was introduced in both the 112th and 113th, and because tax measures have not been moving in the last two Congresses, it didn't go anywhere. But it did have bicameral, bipartisan support. It has been led by Chairwoman Stabenow. It's been led by Congressman Nunez out of California. We're not going to dwell on this, but I do want you to understand that there's a lot of supporters for this effort. This is only a handful of the universities that have found value in this. And more importantly, and if you can read that, your eyes are far better than mine, what you should be able to see here is that in a sector that often is characterized as fussy and backbiting to its own self, we have broad-based support for this idea. So where are our next steps? New Congress, new makeup, new committee leadership, We have new opportunities. We need active voices, though. We're in the process of not determining if this fits our new agenda for this Congress, but how and where. So you should know that we are still committed to this effort. The list of people are still committed to this effort. But we need additional voices. We need those that have been supportive to be active voices. And so we are continuing to recruit. I've provided my contact information up here. If there's anyone who would like to know more about AROs, what we're trying to achieve, and how they can impact, I would love the opportunity to visit with you further. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And thanks to the whole panel for a very interesting presentation. I think now we're ready for questions. Because this is being audio cast, I would ask that in approaching the microphone and raising your question that you identify yourself, please, and your organization. We have a first question.
Hi.
Is that on?
Go ahead. Okay. I'm Mark Gorman with the Northeast Midwest Institute. Thanks, everyone, for enlightening presentations. I have a couple questions for Keith on the international landscape. One is, what were the differences between the UK and the Netherlands' divestment of public research, such that the UK research and ag stagnated and succeeded in Holland? And then the second is, if given the dramatic uptick in research investment in China and the recent increase in the EU, would one potential solution be to not see the research as a competitive with the United States, but to catalyze exchanges in research? And if that's the case, what are the barriers to that exchange? Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Keith Hughley from ERS. Regarding the comparison between the UK and Netherlands experience, they were the main difference, I think, was in the United Kingdom, they actually privatized their main public agricultural research center. In other words, they sold it to a private company. And the government support for that then really withdrew. And even though it brought in more private support, the overall funding for agricultural research stagnated, particularly for the more fundamental basic research, just wasn't carried out. And so overall funding for research, agricultural-oriented research in the UK stagnated, and subsequently so did productivity. Now, in the Netherlands, they did actually privatize their extension service, made it into kind of a private consulting company. Their research system they kept in the public domain, but transformed it into a public corporation that actively sought the support from both industry and government. And the government funding, mainly through competitive grants, stayed quite robust. Well, there was both a mix of competitive and capacity grants for that new public organization that was also closely linked with their major agricultural university. And so they were able to maintain both more industry funding as well as robust public funding for that new organization. And that has been quite a successful model for them, I think, in continuing to raise their overall agricultural productivity over time. Now, with regard to the international scene, I think you've hit upon a very interesting and important point that the United States no longer has or doesn't appear to have the same kind of dominant position in global agricultural science as we once did, and that there are other players such as China, such as Brazil, such as the European Union and elsewhere that are becoming very prominent players in pushing the science frontier forward for global agriculture. And so it is a new opportunity for us actually to think about how we can collaborate better, share information better, have some kind of coordination mechanisms to make better use of that new global resource. And there are some initiatives underway to try to achieve that. For example, the in the G20, there is now an annual meeting of the chief agricultural scientists, and they get together and discuss ways of how to share big data and how to have more open and coordinated research effort across those major agricultural research systems. And you know, that's there's you know, the China, there are institutional barriers to that. Some countries have a less of a tradition of sharing information or technology. For example, China does not allow the exportation of any plant germplasm. So if you do breeding in China, it's really hard to, you know, get that to incorporate advances that they're making in plant varieties and use that material in U.S. breeding programs. The reverse is not true. U.S. is very open, and particularly, you know, the Agricultural Research Service is very open with sharing its plant germplasm. So there are some different traditions in these research systems that do prevent some of this sharing of information and technology. But I think that, you know, this is something that we should be paying a lot more attention to and trying to further.
Thank you, Keith. Next question.
Yes, we have a question from our audiocast audience. Mark Smith from Cornell University asks, it seems to me like we are not only speaking about research program, about federal research program funding, our food and ag research infrastructure also suffers from negative trends in state funding, finding new revenue to maintain and renew the capital and human resources is now and will be critical to the research enterprise. He'd like to hear the perspective from our panelists on meeting these additional challenges.
Why don't we start with Steve and work this way?
Well, I mean, I think the challenge is one, mandatory funding versus discretionary funding. And as we see, both, it's reflective not only in the state governments, but also the federal government, as mandatory funding programs continue to rise, there's less and less discretionary funding. So his comment is actually, it's right. You see it on Keith's earlier slides. I mean, there's been a decrease in state and federal funding, and that's why we have to begin to look at alternatives. It's not like this money is going to magically appear. It's just not. So what are the other ways that we're going to use to fill that delta? We don't anticipate that these other alternative funding mechanisms will decrease state and federal funding. These are two different pathways of support. The challenge is having the recognition that the state governments and the federal governments have a lot of obligations, and how do we still fit within discretionary funding models?
Matthew?
The newly created Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research does represent a small step in a new direction, and that is through the matching requirement. And there is no reason why that foundation can't partner with states in a matching concept and in effect double up what states can otherwise provide.
Harold?
Just a couple of comments. And in the larger agricultural states, and Florida is one of those, urbanization is really having a major impact on people's recognition and interest in investing in agriculture. And so there's pressure downward. And then at the state level, at least from my experience, agricultural entities compete with one another for a fixed amount of state resources, and it's very difficult to recruit additional money even when there are state surpluses. So I think those are symptoms maybe of the statement made by the question.
Keith?
Yeah, Keith Thigley from ERS. You know, if we go back and we look at the history of the public agricultural research system, one way that policy incentivized state governments to fund agricultural research was that federal formula funds provided to states required a state matching. And that got a lot of governments saying, you know, we got farmers in those states to really lobby their legislatures. We want that federal match, put up some money to our state experiment station. Now, with the demise of formula funding, what more of the USDA extramural grants is going in terms of competitive grants, and there's good reasons for that. But with the demise of formula funds for research, you know, the state matching requirement is not as robust as it once was. So that is sort of to reduce some of the incentives on the parts of states to continue to fund agricultural research. But another aspect is that much of the research that's coming out of the state universities really benefits the nation. And, you know, a lot of work has shown this, that, you know, what Florida does, what Iowa does, carries benefits much beyond the state borders. And so there's not as strong as incentive on the part of those states to, I mean, they're really focused on what's of benefit to their users. So there is a strong economic argument that can be made why these kind of matching efforts are important to incentivize local funding, state funding, private funding for agricultural research.
So while we're waiting for the next question, I have a question. Steve, without going too deeply into the tax law weeds, I wonder if you could describe to us why a tax law change is needed to encourage more philanthropic investment in agriculture. Why can't a private foundation simply take contributions from tax deductible contributions today and funnel it into agricultural research?
If you see me getting into the weeds, throw up a hand, because it's easy to do. The way the tax law is set up now, if you take MROs out of it, if someone were to step up and provide a large endowment, they automatically become a private foundation. The Noble Foundation, my organization, is a private foundation, and we conduct operations. We were created in about 1940. We were created in 1945, and we've evolved over the last 70 years. What we see traditionally is there's been a number of individuals of wealth who have visited us and say, I want to do this in my own geography. I want to do this with my own species, whether it be cattle or equine. And what you inevitably see is they don't do it. Because if you went to an advisor, a lawyer, an accountant, and you said, you know what, pull the annual documents, the Noble Foundation files, and let's look at their model and let's recreate this, they would all say the same thing. You don't use a private foundation for doing this. You do it to give money away. So as a consequence, that's what caused us to go to the tax code from the first part. There are really three different organizations that you can look at. Private foundations, which aren't conducive to doing these type of operations. There are publicly supported public charities. And what you require there is more than 30% of your operating funds to come from the public at large. So if you want to look and compare between human medical research and agricultural research, look at that point. We talk about, and we do it, that there's not enough public research funds in here. Look at those numbers. There are hundreds of independent medical research organizations, nonprofits in this country. There are roughly four in the plant sciences. Boyce Thompson, the Danforth Center, the Carnegie Plant Biology Group, a little piece of the Salk Institute, and then you've got the Noble Foundation as a private foundation. There's no better indicator of the lack of public monies out there. So if you can't create it with a private foundation and you can't create it from public support, what's left? And that's where we found the model with medical research organizations.
Thank you. Neil?
The live audience is going to have to get live because the online audience is really
cooking.
So for all of the panel members, how much do you estimate is needed to adequately fund U.S. ag research annually over the next decade?
Keith, do you want to start?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, but I will just cite the President's Advisory Council for Science and Technology released a report a couple of years ago now. And that was a science council made up of not agricultural scientists, but a broader set of very prominent scientists that advised the President on science policies. They took a look at the federal preparedness of the agricultural research system. They advocated increased funding on the order of $700 million per year on top of approximately $2 billion that is currently allocated to agricultural research in the USDA.
Harold?
The only comment I would make is that consistently we hear that the return on investment in agricultural research is high, and yet the percentage of investment return into that research is among the lowest in industries and private firms particularly. So rather than throw out a number, I would just say that we have a long ways to go to compete with other industries that are looking to the future to solve their own problems.
Matthew?
Urban, I defer to my colleague Keith from USDA. He is the expert in this area.
Okay. Steve?
I would agree with
Okay. Neil, another question?
Oh, yeah. I've got, as I said, our audio cast audience is live today. This is another question from Cornell. What is your best advice on rallying producers and their organizations to the cause of building and growing private sector funds for food and agricultural research? And I think I would, if I were asking the question, I would amend that to be both for building and growing private sector funds and public sector funds for agricultural research.
And to whom is the question directed?
To the entire panel.
Okay. Steve, why don't you start?
I think more than anything, it comes from education. And we can see this, and one of the vehicles that we've contemplated, if AROs, when AROs become reality, it's going to come through the land grants. We have the largest connection with producers in their area with their land grants. And through the normal conversations with universities, it's been a couple of very progressive universities, Iowa State in particular, that talked about their development officers would contemplate this is how the mechanism would work. We've got education through either trade associations. We have relationships through these universities. It's one of education. It's to show them, and perhaps some of these constituents get their education from other areas. If you're talking about medical research or you're talking about setting up private foundations outside any of these sectors. But I think we're going to have to depend on the mechanism we have best, and that's the land grants to educate these producers as to the options for them in providing private wealth into this sector.
Matthew?
From my perspective, I'm an advocate of the matching concept, of partnering concept that has proven to be successful. But I'd go back to our friends at Cornell and do the extra homework to take advantage of as many matching partnerships as possible.
Harold?
Well, I think I underscored in my presentation that one of the challenges for looking to industry for support is during good times, they're less interested in investing in research. And during crises, they need it yesterday. And so I think, as Steve indicated, education is important. But one of the things that we found is once a plan was put in place with outside input from the National Research Council, all of a sudden it made a lot of sense to look forward to expanding the industry's resources. So maybe that partnership with the land grant institutions to build a plan and then try to fund that, I think would be very helpful.
Keith.
Yeah, if we look at, current producer groups do have authority to raise money for, as has been pointed out earlier, for research and for market promotion through commodity checkoff funds and so forth. And, as we see, there's a lot more interest, there tends to be a lot more interest on the part of these producer groups to fund promotion, market promotion, than research. And I think, there's lots of reasons for that. One reason is that, market promotion yields real short-term benefits. And by increasing the demand for your homogeneous product, that really benefits all producers. Now, research and technical change operates a little bit differently. So if I fund research at this university that develops technologies, farms are very heterogeneous. And some farmers are going to be able to adopt those research, those new technologies more quickly than others. And those early adopters are the ones who are going to be capturing the biggest share of the benefits over time. So there's not only are, research generating benefits for the industry far into the future, they may not be as equally shared amongst the industry as, say, a market promotion type effort would be. So there are real incentive problems to getting producers to support the industry, even though it's really in the industry's best interest over the long run. And therefore, I think, just echoing Mr. McKenna's remarks, is that this matching concept can be very important. And as Dr. Browning also showed in the Florida citrus case, that when there's money on the table and you can show producers that, look, if you guys raise some money, we can double that by getting matching contributions from a government or other source, that can be a powerful incentive to raise producer support for agricultural research at these public institutions.
Neil, another one?
They just keep pouring in. Rachel Lane from Farm World asks, Keith,
You mentioned that the Netherlands have maintained support for ag research. Can you expand on their plan, and are there any aspects of what they've been doing that we can use in the U.S. today?
Well, of course, Netherlands is a very small country, so it has some lessons for the United States, but it's more like a state rather than a national system, because it's a much smaller country with a much more focused agricultural system. But it's interesting that when they initiated their first sort of round of reform and they took their research, their public research institute, and made it into a private corporation, a public corporation, I should say. So it was a nonprofit corporation, but with a much more of a profit model toward it, and really had to go out and raise a lot of its own money. They, after a few years, actually reversed themselves a little bit and said, you know, that's getting a little too distant, this new organization, from fundamental agricultural research. And so then they recombined it with their agricultural university and actually went back to a model very similar to what we have in the United States, where we have a College of Agriculture together with a state agricultural experiment station. So we have that teaching, research, extension linkages built closely in with the organization. But so that new kind of orientation of that system with heavy involvement from producers was effective at raising both new industry money, but also had strong support from their Ministry of Agriculture to provide capacity as well as competitive funding for research projects. Now, another thing that, Netherlands as a small country also has relatively small number of farms, and we're talking about maybe, in their horticultural sector, maybe 16,000 farms. It's a lot easier to organize producers when you're dealing with a smaller group, very commercially oriented, than in a much larger situation like you have here in the United States. So there are some lessons there. I think, for me, the real take-home lesson is that when we think about raising support from industry or from producers for public research, that it is really to complement, but it can't really substitute for continued robust funding from government expenditures.
Neil, another, or do I?
Oh, no. I'm working my way through the list here.
Oh, okay.
This question is for Mark McKenna. Has the foundation set priorities for the types of proposals it would like to consider for potential funding?
The question is whether we have a list of priorities for the proposals. No, not yet. We are anxious to receive any ideas. I think at this point, it's better that those ideas be done informally or casually, and they can certainly be submitted to me at this point. But we are soon going to have very specific guidelines and very specific ranges of areas for suggestions and for proposals. But at this point, it's premature. As I said before, our board meeting dedicated to the strategic plan of the operation is next week, and we'll shortly be communicating just the type of guidelines and processes we're expecting.
Neil?
Okay. This question is for Harold Browning. Have any other ag sectors been copying what the model that you've been working with in the citrus industry in Florida, and or have any of them come looking to talk with you about what you're doing there to try and build something in their own areas?
First to the question of are there other commodities looking at this? We get a lot of questions from other commodities that have similar challenges, and I'll speak a little bit about the other states that are growing citrus, and we've borrowed from the California Research Board that's been in place for 60 years now in terms of how we set our organization up. So there is some coordination and cooperation that helps alleviate the challenge I mentioned about different states are in different time points and so on. The other piece that's probably closest to what we're doing is there's a related disease that's attacking potatoes and tomatoes caused by a similar bacterium, and the opportunity exists for similar work to be conducted across these model systems. And so we've had a lot of communication with the potato industry and research communities around these same issues. But I think directly to the point, a similar organization has not emerged that is doing for their industry what CRDF is set up to do.
I have a question for Matthew McKenna. You mentioned in your remarks that that FFAR is looking to hire an executive director. You have an audience here of people who are interested in the topic. Would you like to describe what your ideal candidate would look like and invite invitations to apply?
It's a bit premature, and that is that the scope of the foundation's activity remains to be decided. For example, how much research will it be conducting directly? How will it conduct research perhaps indirectly? How quickly is it looking to expand the asset base of the foundation? Those requirements will all be potential requirements for the first executive director, and that depends upon the board coming to grips with exactly how it expects to manage its operations. Those decisions are going to be made very quickly. So subsequent to those decisions, we will have quite a detailed job description that will be available for that executive director role. Stay tuned on when that's going to be announced, but it shouldn't be that much longer.
Thank you. Allison?
Hi, Urban. We have another question from the audio cast. This is again from Mark Smith at Cornell University, and he asks, Keith, given the setbacks you've described in the Australian levy system, what efforts are they making to correct their mistakes and get back to the fueling productivity growth through research?
Yeah, there's an ongoing debate in Australia on the future of funding for their agricultural research system. On the one hand, there's actually one lobby that's even trying to further reduce public support for the system and turn it more over to industry. But there are also some other interesting models that have evolved recently to try to raise new producer support for research. And one model that they're looking at is what they call endpoint royalties on new crop varieties. And so these research and development centers that focus on particular commodities have set up some quasi-public seed corporations that are joint ventures between private seed companies and these public research entities that are developing, particularly in the area of crop improvement for wheat and some of the other major commodities that they grow. And then what they will do is at the end point, when the farmers bring their grain to the elevator, they'll sort it out by commodity, figure out, and levy a tax levy at that point, and then use that to fund the institute or the company that provided that bred that variety that has intellectual property on that variety. So it's a little bit different from in the United States. Of course, a lot of companies, you know, they charge technology fees or on varieties in which they own patents, so the farmer pays it in terms of the price of the seed. Here they're trying to look at paying it at the price of point of sale of the grain. And there's some differences. I think when you have an endpoint source, endpoint royalty paid on your seed, you have more risk sharing in terms of how that technology performs between the breeder and the producer. So there are some advantages to that system. There also seems to be some that when you charge at the endpoint source, you get actually a greater share of that technology fee going back to support research rather than other kinds of activities of a company or an organization. So that's an interesting model to see how it develops. I'm not sure how well that would apply yet to the United States, but that's one thing that Australia is looking at to try to boost, basically raise more industry support for its public research system.
My name is Katie. I work with Matt on the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research, but my question is for Steve. You spoke a lot about the medical research organizations and how the agriculture research organizations could copy those funding models, but I guess what I'm wondering is if there isn't a place for agriculture research organizations in hospitals and alongside those medical research organizations. Could you talk a little bit about where you see those spots?
Sure, absolutely.
If you look at the fundamental research model, of course, there's a lot of things that lead to food, of course, and then food, of course, to human health and nutrition. So there are probably some crossover sciences that could lend itself to medical research organizations. What we see since the mid-1950s is we don't see anybody doing that. So that stands as much as an example as anything to say agriculture is not taking advantages of these. So the definition arguably could get there, but we're not seeing people do that. But it could be, to some degree, people are unaware of this option. We think that the better approach would be to broaden this definition to include the other half of the life sciences so it's clear that plants, animals, aquaculture, soil would be an appropriate candidate for agricultural research organizations.
I think we have one question from the live audience coming up and then another from the audio cast.
Hi, my name is Robin Shane from the National Research Council, and actually I have two questions if there's time. This is really for the full panel. The first is whether you might, of course, the partnership with industry is welcome and appropriate. I wonder if you might comment on then sort of the balance of fundamental research versus applied, because I would imagine that with industry partnering, there might be a sort of a bias or tendency to focus on the more applied. And that's perhaps appropriate, but would you think that that might affect the nature of sort of the public side of funding?
Why don't we start with Keith and go through the panel?
No, I think this is a real critical issue, that if we look toward models that bring in more, say, industry support, and I think, you know, Harold in his presentation did allude to this, that, you know, growers and producers are really interested in, you know, what's in it for me today? But if we look at what drives agricultural productivity over the very long run, it's really this fundamental research in basic agricultural sciences that are generating the new technology platforms. And then later, you know, 5 or 10 years down the road, you'll see commercialized by private applied research often into actual technologies that farmers adopt. But unless that fundamental research is maintained, then, you know, those new technology breakthroughs may dry up and we run into a situation which, and I think this reflects both the Australian and the UK experience, where a decade or two after those reforms were implemented, they didn't get the public funding for this fundamental research and their productivity of their agricultural sector stagnated. So I think that we need to continue to have a strong voice of the science community as well as industry working together to try to come up with, you know, to keep both sides of the more fundamental issues in agricultural science alongside these more applied problems.
Harold?
I would just add 2 points to my earlier comments. And the first is that our efforts in the industry emergence of an organization was not to either invent the wheel or reinvent the wheel, but rather adopt prevailing information, the best knowledge available to the circumstances of this particular disease. And I think that in a nutshell describes why it's so important to have that continuing science moving forward at the fundamental level. The other comment I'll make is that if you chose a cropping system to develop new pest management, disease management principles, and you chose a disease to work in, ours is probably the worst case from many aspects because it's a perennial crop. To evaluate a rootstock takes 25 years. It's a systemic bacterium that you can't see. And so without being able to translate from other systems, we would not expect to ever make progress in the timely way that's needed. And Robin, thanks to you and NRC for the efforts that were done to help build the business plan and the direction for the citrus response. A lot of people in Florida, myself included, thought we knew what we needed to do, but it was really incredibly important to get the National Council to detail that in a way that the industry felt the confidence to raise the money to move forward. So thank you.
Matthew.
I'm confident that the foundation will obviously make its own decisions with respect to applied and fundamental, but the matching concept is a unique opportunity to double the bet down, so to speak, with the on the fundamental side as well.
I would say in philanthropy, you see the gamut. You see everything from translational to applied, and I don't think we've seen trends or negative trends with regard to that. I think you would see all phases of research undertaken. I did want to follow up 1 second with Katie. As I understand, I think I answered the question slightly wrong. You asked, would there be a place for AROs to partner with hospitals? The issue is, really, are the regulations restrictive in that sense? And they aren't. They really set a floor that says we would encourage the working in conjunctions with universities. However, the partnerships could be with anybody. They could be with business. They could be with government labs. They could be with other nonprofits. The issue isn't really what is the globe of what you can do. It's really what is the floor. And if you're not doing that floor, then you probably got an issue. And that's how those regulations would be set up.
And you had a second question, I believe.
So this is maybe for Steve and Matt, but could be for everybody. So it's often the disconnect of the consumer to agriculture is often bemoaned. But there is great, as you know, an increasing interest in consumers in how their food is grown and in agriculture. So I wonder if there's a potential to tap the interests of the consumer, not necessarily as a taxpayer for input into public funding, although that would be good, for contributions, private contributions to support research in areas that they feel are needed to produce food in the way that they would like it to be. Just as a
Matthew?
It's clear that the foundation, newly created, can accept contributions and can accept matching requests from consumers as well as more typical research partners.
I know they could, of course. They can take it from anybody, but do you think that that segment of the public is a potential to be tapped?
Absolutely.
Steve, did you want to tackle that?
I mean, one of the challenges, and you touched on it, is the fact that we've got a huge disconnect. It's one of the reasons we've started a youth education program at the Noble Foundation, because even in rural Oklahoma, we've had an outbreak, if you will, of youth not understanding that cotton doesn't come from sheep and that strawberries grow from plants, and I'd rather get my beef from Walmart than I would to harm that cow. This is a problem, and youth, of course, will one day become our leaders and our consumers. It is a challenge. So it is critically important that we begin to work to better educate consumers, policymakers, leaders as to where their food comes from. And I think a natural byproduct of that is going to be a greater interest. I talked a little bit in my talk about the fact that we have certain passions for medical research, whether they've an affliction to ourselves or an affliction to our family. We need to invoke that same sort of passion about whether it be the soil, a geography, or a species. And I think that's going to lend itself to increased funding and calling upon a greater source of public funding from the public, not necessarily public funding. You know what I'm saying? Thank you.
Harold?
I'll just relate one point for optimism. In the state of Florida, the Department of Agriculture has assumed the role of school lunches, taken out of the Department of Education, and it's part of an overall effort to promote the notion of fresh from Florida in terms of everything from seafood to fruits and vegetables and so on. And so the Department of Ag now has a direct conduit into school lunch programs, and it's already showing some benefit in terms of at least what people say they're going to do, and that's a first step. And later, of course, you have to see it in their spending habits, but I think there's a great opportunity, and when you have a state who's retired folks and they aren't raising their children as much and so on, there are real challenges, but it is making a difference already. So I think that's a key part for future funding, even if all we're doing is protecting the level of funding that's there now.
Keith, do you have anything to say to that?
More to add to that, thanks.
So excuse me, but I have a question for the questioner. I realize this is a little unconventional, but I'm very intrigued by your question about consumers. And what I guess I want to ask you is, are you talking about literally individual consumers financing research? Or if not, who speaks for consumers?
Well, as we all in Washington interact with a number of different groups, one of the, I would say, groups that I do interact with are people who are interested in changing the food system, sustainable food, people interested in animal welfare. I'll mention that there is a perception that some of our public research is there to benefit this amorphous industry, and that may be considered agribusiness, and that maybe that the focus of research is not in the public interest. I've had conversations with people thinking about, you know, well, if you had a research system, what would you want it to fund? And so I'm thinking, you know, where there may be, maybe it's an agricultural research organization that's established to focus on water quality and reduced toxic uses of toxic materials or inputs and improving environmental outcomes versus strictly productivity, though I know that that's absolutely important. I think that anyone who shops at Whole Foods drops a lot of money at that store.
It's called Whole Paycheck.
Right. If they thought that that money was going to research that would make us, say, you know, less reliant on inputs that they perceive as being risky, or to better health, you know, maybe they're a resource to be tapped with the right sort of, you know, quote unquote marketing message and the right vehicle to accept those funds.
Could I ask then the panel if anyone would like to address that point? Steve?
I think it's consistent with what we outlined. I don't think there's going to be restrictions on what the cause or effect would be, whether it's a passion for, as you outlined, or if it's a passion for a geography. A lot of these mechanisms have to get to a point where they can accommodate that, or we're going to be, again, solely dependent on public dollars.
So USDA has a long tradition of nutritional research as well, and I expect the foundation would reflect that as a priority.
Earl, Keith?
Well, you know, I would say I think that there's probably a room for, and some of the other panelists referred to, you know, the need for more public education on the relationships between, you know, productivity change in agriculture and many of these sort of other aspects such as environmental health. Because actually, when we try to look at these questions, you know, these are often joint goods. In other words, if you raise agricultural productivity, what you're doing essentially is you're producing more with fewer resources. And so we've seen, for example, in the United States, over the last 20 years, we're using less land in agriculture, we're actually using less water in irrigated agriculture, we're using fewer pesticides in agriculture, and yet production has gone way up. And so if you look at, you know, and even greenhouse gas emissions haven't really fallen, but they haven't risen, even though production continues to rise. So there's been actually a significant environmental gains as a byproduct of much of the productivity improvements that we've been talking about that probably is not well understood by the general public.
Thanks. Allison, do you have a question?
Another question from the audio cast comes from Jade Garrett from Iron Goat Tech, and which asks, would the scope of the research include hardware technology development? Just to anyone on the panel.
What kind of technology development?
Hardware technology development.
Matthew?
I don't see any reason why it would be excluded for the new foundation. That's certainly that hardware has a meaningful role in productivity and in agriculture. So there's no reason to exclude it from the agenda of the foundation.
Anyone else like to touch on that? Okay.
Yeah, actually, I'll ask a follow-up question that I'll address to Keith, and if anybody else would like to
would like to tackle it as well, that would be good. A lot of the focus in agricultural research tends to be on the on the biological side, especially when we focus on public research policy. There is a history of a longstanding history of public investment in mechanical technology as well, but that's gone up and down in part in response to public reaction to the effects on agricultural labor. So with information technology and precision agriculture playing a much bigger role in actually how we leverage biological technology today, what do you see as the future for public sector investment in both IT and mechanical technology as opposed to biological technology?
Well, even in biological technology, and maybe this is a good model that we might expect for these other technology areas, is what we've seen is with very significant growth in the seed industry, in their research capacity and application of biotechnology tools to crop breeding, we've seen actually the public sector change its focus and move resources out of what we call cultivar development, in other words, you know, breeding the final variety that you provide to farmers, and moving more of their resources into upstream research, plant breeding tools, and also the what we call germplasm enhancement, bringing new exotic genetic traits into the breeding pools that then companies use to breed their final varieties. And we've seen this also take place in livestock breeding, by the way. So we have these very unique roles, more upstream research versus the downstream research that each sector plays, and that way they complement each other very well. Now, in some of these new areas of particularly the IT area, now this probably isn't something that our land-grant colleges have really focused on, but there are big potential spillovers from the colleges of engineering and so forth, where a lot of these developments are taking place. But you still often need this intermediate developer to take some of those basic concepts and say, you know, how do we use them in an agricultural context? How do we take all of the climatology and soil information to combine it with information management tools in a way that can translate into much more efficient use of, say, fertilizers and other inputs in a way that we can continue to rise, you know, to increase the overall productive use of these resources.
Are there any other questions from either the live or audiocast audience? Would any of the panelists like to make a final kind of closing remark? Matthew?
I'd like to thank the Farm Group Foundation for this panel. It's great to have this much publicity and attention given to a very important topic. So I appreciate the foresight and the outreach this represents.
Thanks. Anyone else? Well, thank you very much. I'd ask you to give the panel a round of applause.
Thank you, Urban, and thanks to all of you on the panel and those of you in the live audience and audiocast audience for asking some really good and probing questions. Our next forum will be on March 11th, and those of you at this forum should mark that one down, because we're going to be talking in that one about agricultural productivity. And I think that's really a very logical follow-on to what we've been talking about here today. That forum is going to be a joint product of efforts by the USDA Economic Research Service and the Global Harvest Initiative, in addition to Farm Foundation. So we'll look forward to seeing you on March 11th. Once again, thanks for coming.